It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hey, guys. This is Stephen Williams. I played Mr. X on The X-Files, and you're listening to X-Cast and Deny Everything.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and in this episode, the penultimate episode of our Season 3 coverage, we're talking about the rather creepy Wet Wired. And joining me to talk about... I've never said it like that before, actually. Wet Wired. I normally say Wet Wired, you know, so I've mixed it up already. But joining me to help me mix it up... once again, on the X-Cast is Darren Mooney. It's good to have you back.
It is indeed. It's also great to have H's back in W sounds and W words. I really, really appreciate that. Wet Wired.
Wet Wired.
Whip. Yes, but I'm very, very glad to join you, Tony. It's a pleasure as always.
Absolutely, yeah. I think our last one we both did together and was Pusher. Which, as we record this, has not long been released, actually. And we did that way back when. And I don't think we're quite at Pusher levels with this. But, you know, it's a pretty good one we're talking about here. So yeah, let's get straight into the meat of it and start talking about Wet Wired. Wet Wired is the 23rd episode of the third season of The X-Files. It first aired on May the 10th. 1996. It was written by Matt Beck and directed by Rob Bowman. And in this episode, after a series of bizarre murders committed by ordinary citizens who seemed to mistake loved ones and random people for mass murderers, Mulder and Scully end up on a mysterious case involving some strange television signals and a healthy dose of serious paranoia. That's putting it mildly, Darren, I suppose. So, I think, let's do the usual, out of 10, what would you give Wet Wired overall?
I'd probably be a 6.5 or a 7 sort of grade for this. I'd probably be leaning more towards 7. This is one of those rare episodes where, and it's kind of strange that your opinion of a work of art sort of changes between the first time that you watched it and the most recent time that you watched it. In fact, actually, like I went back and I watched the show back in 2013, 2014, 2015 when I was reviewing the sort of third season. And I thought Wet Wired was grand, it was solid, it was okay. You know, it had some problems, some very serious problems I'm sure we'll talk about. But I liked it a bit, I didn't love it. And it's kind of weird going back to it now, where I'm sort of looking at it and I'm wondering, you know, this is much more engaging than I thought it, than I remembered it being. It's much more sort of thrilling. It's saying something a bit more nuanced than I would have thought it was saying back in 2013, 2014. And I think it sort of aged particularly well in terms of like X-Files episodes. And I mean, we talk about the show having aged remarkably well for the era that we're in. I think Wet Wired is one of those great examples of an episode, even within the show, that has aged particularly well. So yeah, I'd probably lean more towards the 7 now than I would have. It would have been like a 6, 6.5 if you asked me this question 3, 4 years ago. But I like it. I don't love it. I think it has some issues. I think those issues are maybe down to the scripting. It is Matt Beck's first script for the show, and I believe his first script in general. He was a special effects supervisor working on it. There's a strong sense that he was assisted by the writing staff, but there's a sort of clumsiness in the plotting that I suspect we'll talk about later that I think holds it back a little bit compared to some of the better episodes of the season. But I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting because I always felt like I loved Wet Wired years ago. And, you know, it's one of those episodes that I have a vivid memory of, you know, because I may have told this story before on the X-Cast, but I used to watch a lot of season 3 and season 4 at my grandmother's, and she was living with my uncle at the time. She's long since passed now, but back then she had this massive TV, and my uncle had like all the gadgets and gizmos, and they used to tape on VHS episodes when I couldn't see them because he had satellite TV and all this kind of thing. And Wet Wired and Tillithukumi, which obviously is the season finale, which we'll talk about next week, were being recorded by my nan at the time. And watching Wet Wired, my point is, watching Wet Wired when it first came out really sticks in my memory, as does Tillithukumi, as a 13, 14-year-old boy in the mid-90s. So I think I had like a real fondness for Wet Wired for many, many years. And I kind of still do. But when you look at it with a bit of distance, I mean, I think I would probably go with a 7.5 to an 8 for this one. So maybe slightly higher than you. But I think it's a funny one because it sort of starts a storyline and then it sort of veers off into something completely different in a way. You know, and I think there was a real attempt to sort of set up the season finale in many respects, set up a lot of the character interactions and some of the points going into the next couple of episodes. And as you said, you know, you can tell that Chris Carter and maybe a couple of other people, Frank Spotnitz, have given this a bit of a polish, because it has those conspiracy elements, it has that undercurrent to what is initially a, you know, a classic sort of subliminal message, you know, storyline, if anything like a thematic sequel to Blood in the second season, that kind of thing. So it's a funny one because it sort of has a bit of a jumble of storylines and a jumble of plots, and it sort of throws a lot into the kitchen sink, really. And I like it, but I think I like the nostalgia of it sort of captured me more for many years. And I think when you look at it critically, it's not quite as good as you remember, but it's still a lot of fun, actually. I mean, there's a lot in here that I remember fondly from the show.
It's really funny that you should mention Blood, because like, and Blood is like the stock comparison. Actually, when I was looking at reviews of it, like the AV Club's reviews and Entertainment Weekly's reviews, Blood is the episode that people keep coming back to in discussion of this episode. And that makes a great deal of sense, because obviously it's a story about subliminal messages and about like experiments conducted on the public to turn them violent and to get them to turn against each other and to have people murdering one another as a result of like this sinister experiment that's being run by people who are just interested in, you know, people as results or as statistics or as numbers or as grids in a you know, statistical trial. What I find interesting about Wet Wired, and it kind of ties into like the one of the interesting aspects of the third season as a whole, is that I generally see it more as a mirror of the first half of Anasazi, in that it's a story where Scully goes insane and becomes paranoid and stops trusting Mulder, in an inversion of the dynamic that you had at the start of Anasazi, where Mulder is sort of poisoned and stops trusting Scully and becomes paranoid and, you know, becomes untrustworthy and sort of runs off and all this sort of stuff. And it's kind of interesting, even like the visual iconography as well, like the bit where Mulder goes up and discovers the cathode ray tube that they've put in, the sort of the signal blocker that's been installed in order to like add the signal to the television that's going into the house, reminds me a lot of when Scully finds the little cylinder that's been added to the water in Mulder's building in order to drive him mad as well. And it kind of, so that sort of parallel always stood out to me, arguably more than the comparison to Blood. And it's sort of interesting because it's a mirror in a way, because again, this is the, we're building up to, you pointed out there, we're building up to the third season finale, and it feels in some ways like it's reflecting the second season finale as well, in a nice bit of sort of narrative symmetry and structuring, which I really, really appreciated.
That's really interesting. I don't know how many people have really picked up on that, but I think you're spot on there. I think that's absolutely right. I think the Anasazi comparison's, you know, very fitting, really. And obviously, Anasazi didn't have sort of a lead-in episode. You know, like this is very much a lead-in to Tillithukumi, even though they're technically two different stories. Whereas Anasazi didn't get that. You know, Anasazi went straight from Our Town into this massive three-part epic. So yeah, it's almost like they've taken a similar idea, a similar concept, you know, and bolt out an episode from it, really. So that's great. I've not heard that comparison before. That's really interesting. IMDb, which we always do a general aggregate of, rates this one
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Fairly highly, you know, it's an 8.5, so that
what?
Puts it above things. Yeah. Well, oh. Come on, Darren. We know that IMDb is flawed.
Has its own eccentricities.
So that puts it above things like Quagmire, which Carl and Sarah and Zach discussed last week, and I think they
okay.
Were like, what?
Yeah,
no.
I'd be a little bit like what?
Yeah, I know. It puts it above. Well, it puts it underneath, and I keep trolling you with this, because it puts it underneath The Blessing Way, Darren.
Oh.
So, you know.
No, this is much better than The Blessing Way. What is wrong with the world? Why are people like this?
So, it's still one of the, it's still in the higher tier than plenty of other episodes. You know, the ones we've discussed previously, just shade it, you know, the major ones you think of from season 3 do edge it, but not by much. You know, a lot of them are at like 8.7, 8.6, 8.8. So, you know, Wet Wired's quite highly regarded. I think maybe it is because of the fact it's got all these constituent fun elements in it. You know, it's got Mr. X, it's got Skinner, it's got the Smoky Man at the end, you know, it's got this hint of bigger conspiracy. You know, it's got all that fun stuff that people really remember from Wet Wired. The leaps at more than a lot of the specific elements. So, you know, I think that carries it, gives it a bit of buoyancy when it comes to IMDb, which obviously, like Rotten Tomatoes, is accurate.
100%. It's proof. If you want to prove that this is a better episode than, you know, Quagmire, you have a number. You can give that number. That number is bigger than the other number you've given. Therefore, it's objective proof, Tony.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the whole thing. In this era of alternative facts, I think we can alternatively agree that Wet Wired is better than Quagmire. And on that note, okay, so let's dig a little deeper and start talking about Wet Wired. So the episode kicks off with what seems like you're in Monster of the Week territory almost, I think, because, you know, you've got a guy in this really sort of, you know, haunt, creepy wood, you know, he's burying someone who's dead, this guy called Joseph Patnick, I think his name is, and, you know, he's just killed someone, he goes, your killing days are over, and all this kind of thing, and then you get, so at first it feels like that sort of Monster of the Week thing, but then it turns out that it's not what it seems, and that he sees the same man but appear to him just before the end of the teaser. And then it turns out that, you know, it's his wife that he's killed. So it's quite a weird sort of opening. It doesn't necessarily suggest a quasi-conspiracy story, because I suppose that's what this is, isn't it, really? It's like, it's not, it's sort of in the vein of the episodes we've seen in the past that have, you know, the Smoking Man and people like this, in, like, say, Emasculata, you know, which wasn't about the alien virus, but it was about a virus that the same syndicate was still trying to cover up. And in this episode, you know, it's sort of, it falls into that sort of quasi-semi-conspiracy bracket, doesn't it?
It does indeed, that you don't really sort of, like, have anymore. Like, the show kind of established a big sort of Chinese wall between, like, the mythology and the standalones back in DPO at the start of the third season, where Scully's like, hey, I hope that this case that we're working on after this gigantic three-parter doesn't involve government conspiracies and aliens. And Mulder's like, oh, sure, it doesn't. This is just a regular week. And there's a sort of a sense of that. Yeah. And there's, like, after this point, there's a much more, after that point, there's a much clearer delineation between sort of standalone episodes and the mythology. In fact, it's very rare to see characters from the mythology pop up in standalones. You know, you can look at stuff like, for example, Mulder's mother pops up in Paper Hearts, for example, as one exception to that. But very much like when the Smoking Man shows up, it's a way that the show says, this means business, or this is business. And you're right that sort of Wet Wired is interesting because it begins, it sort of seems initially like it's a standalone episode. It feels almost like, say, Soft Light, another episode involving Mr. X, which is otherwise a pretty plain Monster of the Week story. Except what happens here is that instead of it just being a Monster of the Week that involves Mr. X, it sort of builds up towards the fact that by the end of the episode, it's a full-blown mythology episode. It's fascinating because it begins as a Monster of the Week episode, and it ends as like this... It's not really a cliffhanger, but it's kind of a cliffhanger because it sets up a lot of what's coming, and it sets up like a key character beat that will happen in the season bridging two-parter involving Mr. X and the cigarette-smoking man. And it's sort of... Yeah. It feels very much like by the end of the episode that you're in the same territory as like Nicey and 731, or you're in the same sort of area as obviously Apocrypha and Piper Maru, where Mulder is running around chasing people who are doing shady things and experimenting on the public, you know, and sort of like tracking down this conspiracy that he's almost got a hold of, but it slips narrowly through his fingers. And it's kind of interesting because it's not a Monster of the Week with mythology elements so much as it's a Monster of the Week that becomes a mythology episode, which is fascinating. And the only real example of an episode that I can really think of like that after this point is probably like the two-parters, and I apologize, I'm going to mangle the pronunciation of this, you know, the Sein und Zeit two-parter from the seventh season, where that sort of begins as almost a case of the week and then embroils or involves the mythology as it goes.
Edges into it, I suppose, sort of backs into it almost. And yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is, I think. But I suppose it kind of plays its hand fairly early, doesn't it? Because you've got Mulder immediately being, meeting the plain-clothed man, that's got to be the worst moniker for, like... One of the conspiracy. They'd run out, hadn't they? They'd run out of... We've done well manicured, cigarette smoking.
Mr. X.
Mr. X.
Yeah. The next? Elders 1, 2, and 3. Crew Cut Man.
Yeah. Why couldn't they have like really jazzed it up? And why couldn't he have been like Magnum PI and have a Hawaiian shirt? He could have been Hawaiian Shirt Man. That would have been awesome. Like, he would have been really odd.
I do like the plainclothes man is very much on the road towards toothpick man as far as like mythology nicknames go. But I'm like again, to be fair, a part of me kind of like when he showed up, part of me was like, this is poor man's Philip Seymour Hoffman. And like for the rest of the performance, I couldn't help but imagine how cool it would be if like Mulder's one shot guest informant was Philip Seymour Hoffman, who would be a lot more grizzled, a lot more sort of like cynical, and a lot more world weary in his dealings with Mulder. He'd be like, yeah, you don't want to investigate that. That's your business. You do that. Yeah.
Where's the rabbit's foot? Yeah, that kind of thing.
You've got a partner, somebody you care about.
I'm gonna find her. I'm gonna find them. Sorry, guys. We could just probably recite the Mission Impossible 3 script. We won't.
Yeah.
Okay. We won't do Philip Seymour Hoffman. Mission Impossible 3. So yeah, it is a shame that he didn't pop up as the. I'm gonna call him the Hawaiian Shirt Man. I like it more than plain clothed. So let's call him that. That's the weird thing. He doesn't wear Hawaiian shirts. So what? Let's do that.
On his days off. to everybody in the office, he's a Hawaiian Shirt Man. And it's just like when he's wandering around Washington, maybe it's cold out. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just wear some plain clothes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so obviously the plain clothes man turns up. And the interesting thing about this character is that he was played by an actor called Tim Henry. He was very quickly brought in because Stephen Williams, obviously, who plays Mr. X, was unavailable. He was working on a TV show called LA Heat at the time, so which he was pretty much starring in. So he was busy and he couldn't appear for all of the scenes in X. So they rewrote a lot of the scenes that would have featured X. You know, X would have been playing this character, so they had to kind of hastily get another guy in who's sort of, you know, the temporary X. And I mean, it's one of those things that's a circumstance thing, but I kind of like that the way they managed to sort of twist the plot with that, because in the end, then it allows Mulder. It's a neat way of them, and this is where you can see that Carter and Sputnitz have rewritten this, because it's a way they've managed to sort of continue that broiling antipathy between X and Mulder, which has sort of been, even though Mulder doesn't know that X has basically saved his life half a dozen times on the quiet, it sort of allows them to lead into Talitha Kumi by only bringing X in when he's revealed to be having a sense.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry,
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Actually used Mulder through this Hawaiian shirt, man. And it wasn't the plan, it turned out to be quite fortuitous, I think.
It is indeed, and it's worth noting, like, I absolutely love, there's a lot of sly reference to this, like, so for example, when Mr. X says to Mulder, you know, when Mulder's wondering why he didn't get in touch with him beforehand, Mr. X says, I was being watched all the time, and then sort of almost turns to the camera and says, you can see me in L.A. Heat, for example, you can watch me in L.A. Heat. what's interesting about L.A. Heat is that, well, first of all, like, this is the thing that dooms Mr. X as a character in terms of, like, metafiction, in terms of, like, outside the show's production, because it means that, like, Stephen Williams is tied up being a regular on the show, which means he can't be a guest star on The X-Files, which effectively means that his days on the show are perhaps at this point numbered, and not to get too specific or too spoilery. But one of the things that's actually fascinating about L.A. Heat, and I don't know if you know this, Tony, but you don't know, would want to guess when L.A. Heat premiered on American television? I'll settle for a year. When did it first air on American television? Keep in mind, this was shot in May. This was, you know, released in May 1996.
So they would have been shooting this, say, March, maybe. 94, maybe? 94?
1999, apparently.
What? It what?
Yeah, apparently it was distributed overseas first. It was very popular in Germany, where in fact in Germany its second season knocked Baywatch off the number one pole position for American imports in the country. But yeah,
do you mean 1989?
No, I mean 1999, as in the year of the turn of the millennium.
So
this is according to Wikipedia now, so I can't.
It didn't air for like 3 years.
Yep. Yeah.
Whoa, no way. Okay, yeah. Wait.
In America, it was distributed overseas. It was basic, and it only aired, I think, on TNT.
Wow.
In March 1999. And think about how bad that must feel for, like, Stephen Williams, who's, like, giving up this sort of plush recurring gig on The X-Files, which is a pretty, you know, at the moment, it's on the cusp of being, like, this huge cultural sensation. And he's like, I got this role on the show, it's called L.A. Heat, it's a cop show. And people, Americans love cop shows, it's going to be fantastic, it could be like Law and Order. And it's like, yeah, sure, so when's the first episode airing? About 3 years.
Well, it's interesting because, and this is a blatant plug for joining the Patron Zone, but the Patron Zone, we have an interview with Stephen Williams.
Woo!
Right now.
Awesome.
Yeah. Which will be available around February when Heron Vault comes out for everyone else. But if you want to listen to it now, subscribe, become a patron. But yeah, he suggests in that, and I won't go in too much into it because to not spoil the episode, but he suggests there were perhaps certain behind the scenes reasons why X was written out.
Ah, okay.
He's not sure, completely sure, but he's got his own sort of theories as to why that might happen. But yeah, you know, he mentions a little bit about L.A. Heat when he speaks to Kurt North, who spoke to him. But it's a real shame because obviously one of the things that you will hear that comes out of that interview is the fact that he was disappointed big time that X dies. You know, he wanted to carry on playing the character. He loved playing the character. He wanted to carry on playing the character for a long time. So there is that sort of element. You know, when you watch this now and you know that X isn't long for this world, you didn't at the time. Although, you know, you can kind of, by the end, I don't know about you, but the moment he's in that car and he's lying to the smoking man, I know his days are numbered. Do you know what I mean? It's once that trigger's pulled, you know, it feels to me like it's just playing for time. And, you know, when I look back at this now, I wonder if not all of this was part of Smoking Man's plan to suss out this mole, you know, that he had. Because obviously the suggestion is ultimately that over the course of Heron Vault, certainly, that he's, they're all playing, they're playing a game of trying to, you know, push out, suss out who this mole is, who's, you know, leaking information. But there, you know, there's, we'll get onto this later. No, but, you know, there's some interesting, if you look at it from that perspective, it feels a little bit like there might be some bigger games going on here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about Mr. X now or talk about him later, but Mr. X is fascinating. And I think, like, Wet Wired, for all my problems with it, is a great Mr. X episode. And again, you're right that it's because of the contingency of having to write around Stephen Williams' absence. But it sort of creates this sense of, like, tension and sort of tenuousness that you never had with Deep Throat. Like, I remember one of the defining moments for Deep Throat is the bit where, like, Mulder breaks into a top-secret government conspiracy, you know, site and is almost on the verge of discovering the alien body that's being recovered in EBE. And, like, the soldiers have him, and they have him dead to rights. And, like, Deep Throat just walks in and sort of waves them away, and nobody asks why this, like, senior government conspirator who's, like, in charge of protecting the project and keeping it secret from people would let this, you know, FBI agent just wander around for a little while, have a bit of a leaf, and then, you know, sort of walk home afterwards. And so, like, you got the sense that, like, Deep Throat was very much protected until he wasn't at the very end of Erlenmeyer Flask. But whereas with Mr. Yeah. X, there's something a lot more interesting about the dynamic, because he seems more like a grunt. He seems more like a kind of a, like, he seems more middle management than upper management. He seems like he's very much like, he's the guy who takes out the trash. Like, it's no coincidence that he's very good at killing people in a way that Mulder's other informants aren't, because there's a recurring sense that that is the role that he plays in the conspirator. He's in the conspiracy. He's effectively a cleanup artist. And I like the tension that exists, particularly in that final scene between him and the smoking man, because it's very clear that whether or not he's guilty, whether or not, like, the smoking man has evidence, all the smoking man needs to do is just suspect that X is not on the level, and he can have him, like, written off and forgotten about, erased as if he never existed, with just the wink of an eye, and, like, without any need for proof, without, he probably wouldn't even need anybody to co-sign on it. The well-manicured man probably doesn't even know that X exists. And I like that element of, like, the conspiracy, yeah, of the day-to-day running of the conspiracy, and I think it makes X a more interesting character, because he has so much more to lose than, as you point out, than as Mulder realizes, because as you point out, he saved Mulder several times, but Mulder, being maybe not the most, like, attuned to what other people are going through character, with a bit of a sort of a chip on his shoulder and a hero complex, Mulder's maybe not kind of particularly sensitive to the idea that, you know, while working with X can be a bit inconvenient and a bit temperamental and can lead to some tension, you know, X also has, like, his own stuff going on. Mulder's like the little spoiled child. He's like, why can't you be here all the time when I need you? And X is like, I'm trying not to get killed, Mulder. And Mulder's like, yeah, but I want you here now.
This is it. This is the difference. And we've probably talked more about this in the past on the show. But this is the difference between him and Deep Throat, in that Deep Throat was one of the grand architects. He was like the grand, you know, the fatherly figure coming down and giving Mulder this information. And like you said, under a certain blanket of protection until, you know, he pushes it too far. But it was a different thing. Whereas, like you say, X is a grunt. X is one of their X. You know, he said in, I think it was One Breath, you know, which we talked about ages ago, but he talked about how, you know, I used to be you, you know, and so he's not come from that, you know, arch architect, you know, the sort of aristocracy of the syndicate. He's not come from that. He's come from the lower level killing machine, sort of, you know, grungy assassin, and that's why. And we'll talk more about this in Tlathikumi, but there are points where X is terrified in the next few episodes. You can see it on his face. And that, and you know, you didn't see that in the same way with someone like Deep Threat. So it's a very different dynamic. And I think one of the best things about these next two episodes is what it does with that relationship with Mulder. Because like you say, Mulder does come off as a bit petulant. You know, he comes off as someone who doesn't really appreciate necessarily the sacrifice and the danger that X he's putting himself under, even though X has said it to him many times and said, you know, I risk my life every time I come to you, right? And that's why I'm not going to be chummy. I'm not your pal. I'm here to actually, you know, there's a bigger picture here, and all I can do is feed you scraps. And Mulder's like, yeah, like stomping his feet. And it is that certain bit of entitlement with Mulder, which is something that's an interesting factor of his character. But yeah, it builds to a good scene, and, you know, I think it does add something to the episode. But obviously before we get to all this, you've got the main chunk of the plot which they investigate for, you know, the majority of the storyline, which is all about, you know, discovering these tapes, and there's this mysterious doctor, Dr. Strowman, who is, working with this guy who believes he killed five people, believing they were all a Serbian mass murderer, which feels like it's a little bit of a, well, it's definitely a link to Slobodan Milosevic, definitely, because this is post-Serbia, you know. This is, I don't know if this was the point where Milosevic was still in power, or he'd been toppled, or he was wanted for war crimes, or he was on trial for war crimes, or one of these things, but I think his name's Radoslav Mirosevic in this, so it's very much a nod to, you know, the fact that Serbia and all these atrocities have been in the news. So it's tapping in that way into the real world, to the politics, isn't it?
Do you know what? And I feel really bad about this. I feel like kind of guilty every time that I watch the episode and it reminds me of this particular thing. But what the opening scene reminds me of is Casino, which would have been released, I think, 2 years earlier than it. And there's a moment where Joe Pesci is talking about how when you're getting rid of a body, what you want to do is you want to have a number of holes pre-dug. Because what happens is somebody comes along while you're trying to get rid of the body, and then all of a sudden you got to dig two holes. And part of me is sort of like, I know that it doesn't happen while he's digging the body. He comes home and he's washing the blood off. But when the cops interrupt him, part of me is like, see, he didn't properly plan his body disposal before he sort of got into the act here. And that's sort of what it reminds me of a little bit. But it is very much informed, I think, by that's sort of what's happening in Eastern Europe at the time. And it's worth noting as well that it's later revealed that his parents were Holocaust survivors as well, which is a recurring fascination of the X-Files, and for Chris Carter in particular, is this idea of, like, the atrocity and genocide and all this sort of stuff, and, like, mass murder. And obviously, like, it becomes very clear in the next episode that what the conspirators are planning isn't too different from, like, that sort of ethnic cleansing and that sort of mass murder. And even, I think, like, we talked a little bit about Harsh Realm. Harsh Realm, I think, also opens in Eastern Europe around the same time as this as well. So, like, that sort of ethnic cleansing and genocide and stuff, which is something the X-Files is very, very nervous about and very anxious about, is very much at the forefront of the episode's mind, even from the beginning, which I think is a nice little sort of semi-subtle nod towards the show's core themes and ideas.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Mentioning how Harsh Realm, another patron plug, you can find that episode if you subscribe to become a patron. And we will get released eventually once we get to the point where Harsh Realm is in the 1013 sphere. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, undercurrent subtext there, which is interesting to the backbone of the main story, which is obviously the idea that Matt Beck wanted to get across, which was this idea of subliminal messaging and this, you know, influencing people's, you know, thought patterns and that kind of thing through the television set. And he'd been inspired to write the episode after he'd heard debates concerning violence on television and its effects on viewers. And he pulled things from neurology texts and things like that, but in putting them in the script. But then obviously a lot of that was stripped back when, you know, Carter and whoever got their hands on the script and then did the retooling as they set up the season finale and made it much more of a sort of a thriller story, really, once Scully starts to, you know, go a bit off the deep end. But it's got some interesting, I think, ideas in there about, you know, what this government experiment is doing. And, you know, the idea that, you know, watching, and obviously the fact Scully gets infected, in inverted commas, with this, you know, this subliminal aspect is because she's watching all these tapes. And it feels like it taps into something that back then there was a lot of concern, wasn't there, about violence on television and the effects it has on, you know, on especially young people's minds, you know. And you get a scene, don't you, where Mulder and Scully come in and they find the two boys watching Die Hard. Bunking off watching Die Hard. Awesome, awesome plan. Big bowl of popcorn, massive telly. 2 in the afternoon watching Die Hard. Absolute legends. But
I admire the care they put into it. It isn't like they broke in and were just like, whatever's on television. It's no. We actually popcorn, we get drinks. It's like, this is like a proper, like, school, like, you know, mates sort of almost like date night. It's like, this is sort of like, this is what male friends do. It's like, we're doing this properly. If we're going to break into somebody's house and watch pay-per-view television, we're going to get a big bowl of popcorn. We're going to sit comfortably. Don't put your shoes on the leather. That's, you know, that's not how we do it here.
Yeah, and, you know, great choice, and great that it comes in just at the moment that the helicopter's exploded at the top of Nakatomi Plaza. But it's sort of, I suppose, he's tapping into this idea that, you know, young impressionable minds can be corrupted by the power of the television, and it's still something back then that I think it's one of those primal fears that the X-Files was always tapping into, really, isn't it? You know, this idea of corruption through the TV set.
Yeah, there's something interesting in this, because this is, like, I alluded to it when I gave the score at the start of the episode. One of the things about this episode is that my opinion of it has sort of changed slightly. And I mean, I think my review of it from, you know, back when I was writing them was originally quite sort of cynical about this. I thought it was quite a moral panicky episode. And to a certain extent is, it would have been written, as you pointed out, during a whole host of, like, cultural discussions about this. For example, the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, I think would have been signed in February, so a couple of months earlier, where Bill Clinton had basically signed into law the V-chip, which was designed to stop children from watching violence or sex on television, and was responsible for stuff like the ratings that you now see on American television and stuff like that. And it's kind of like that whole debate is interesting in a number of ways, most obviously because it's filtered through, and like years later with Columbine you have discussions about violence in video games, whether it's Doom, whether it's their Grand Theft Auto and stuff like that. But one of the things I find interesting about the V-chip is how rarely it was used. All the surveys that have been done since, particularly in the early 2000s, 2004, they found that like only 15% of parents actually used the V-chip in the television to stop their children from watching this, you know, heavy rated programming or sort of like more violent or more sexual content, which I find interesting for all the like panic and concern that it generated in terms of media coverage and in terms of like debates around the same time. And I think I was skeptical of the episode when I was younger, and even like 5-10 years ago, because I'm wary of the argument that like seeing sex or seeing violence on screen immediately warps a person's mind. I think when you're a young kid, obviously your parents should regulate what you watch. Your parent, you know, as a parent or a grandparent, your job is like to regulate what children see, and you can judge. A parent is the best judge for what a child is able to watch and able to absorb and able to consume. But I do also think that there's occasionally a sense of puritanical sort of quality to it, where it's not like keep these out of children's hands. It's like don't show this at all. Don't have this level of violence and stuff, or don't have this sort of depiction of sex in anything, even for consenting adults or people over 18 and over 21. And I was sort of wary of that, and I sort of sensed, like, when I was watching it, a bit of moral panic. And to be fair, like, Mulder is perfectly in character when, like, he's scoffing at the, like, there's a moment where Scully says, maybe there's a connection. And Mulder's like, what, between what he saw and what he did? And Mulder's very clearly not buying this whole argument that maybe they saw something violent on television and did something violent. But what I will say has aged very well, and what I think I've sort of like I've softened on the episode because of it, is the sense that like maybe it's not a direct causal one-on-one. Maybe it's not as simple as like watching something violent and doing something violent, which I think a lot of the discussion and rhetoric around censorship and violence in media can be about. It's more about like passive absorption of stuff, and it happens a number of times in the episode where like even the wife who shoots her, you know, what she believes to be her husband and the blonde with the shotgun, she's, you know, passively watching television while doing the dishes. She's doing the dishes and it's on in the background. She's not even sitting down to consume it, and it's not a violent show. I think it's a talk show or it's a game show she's watching. And it's more about how we passively absorb kind of media and how that maybe warps our perspective and stuff like that. Like Kurt Anderson had this really great article that he wrote for The Atlantic, I think, late last year. And he's expanded into a book. Which is about, like, and again, I don't think he's entirely accurate, but when he talks about, like, the idea of America's popular consciousness having drifted away from reality because we're invested in, like, ideas of film and television and fictional real estate and even the subprime crisis where you're selling stuff that doesn't exist, I don't think it's particularly an American thing. I think that even if you look at, say, Britain and Ireland, where you have stuff around Brexit, where you have, like, the media coverage of things like immigration or the media coverage of things like crime in inner urban cities, where you have this idea of, like, the media that we passively consume, whether it's television, whether it's radio, whether it's just print media that's being put out by, say, the you know, the Red Top Press in the UK, where it's pushing a particular agenda through repeated signaling and repeated messaging, through like hammering that idea repeatedly and continuously so that it's absorbed by people who don't even know that they're absorbing it. Like when you look at the headlines of your tabloid newspapers, you don't think, well, this is obviously part of an agenda to make me wary of immigration or to make me sort of worry about crime in the inner city or to make me nervous or scared. You think, well, that's a horrible story they're telling about that one thing that happened. And it's very similar to the story they told yesterday about that other thing that happened. And I think that maybe Wet Wired is sort of getting at that, at this idea. And it's telling.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
That, like, for Scully, it becomes paranoia because it hammers down and it sort of chips away. And I think that, like, over the past couple of years, what we've seen is that media in general, and particularly new media, has in some ways sort of, like, upped the level of paranoia and mistrust. And we've had this breakdown of, like, consensus reality and agreement on, like, what are acceptable terms of conversation, but also in terms of what we fundamentally believe as a culture and about other people. And it's kind of interesting watching Wet Wired in 2018, where Scully, because she's watched this videotape, believes that her partner is betraying her, can't be trusted, has turned against her, and, you know, she tries to murder him. And you look at, like, the heightened climate that we're in at the moment, where people are getting these signals that are being sent through media channels, through social media, through the bubbles that we've constructed. And part of me thinks Wet Wire has actually aged remarkably well. The X-Files is a show about paranoia, and we've arguably never been more paranoid and mistrustful, but Wet Wired in particular ties that back into media in a way that I think is really interesting and has aged probably better than I thought it would have even 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's funny because you've crystallized that really well. And it's funny because as you were talking about that, I was thinking if you were to remake Wet Wired now, the channel would absolutely, I think, fit social media. You know, it would fit exactly what you've been saying in terms of, you know, all these messages that are going through, whether it's political, whether it's social, or you know, all these ideas. It is coming through, you know, Facebook, Twitter, all of these different things that we're looking at on a daily basis. You know, the whole Black Mirror idea, you know, this in a way it would make a good Black Mirror episode now, because it is that whole idea that you're looking at a screen and you're all this data, all this information, all these ideas are hitting you. And in this case, obviously, it's nefarious. You know, it's using, you know, like in Anasazi, you know, and like in Blood, it's using technology in order to sort of influence for whatever nefarious agenda the government have. But in our world, it's a tool of control. It's a tool of agenda. It's not necessarily this nefarious cabal, you know, in a room in New York plotting the end of the world. It is just the media barons, you know, all these people, all these government officials. So it's a different kind of thing, but it's playing in the same sort of wheelhouse. And I think that This is slightly ahead of its time in that sense, even though it wasn't ahead of its time in a way, but it's sort of retroactively
which is remarkable, isn't it?
It's one of those weird things that the X-Files occasionally does. And, you know, we've talked before, haven't we, about how Chris Carter was able to see what's coming.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think Chris Carter was ever been able to predict what we've got now. But in a weird way, it's kind of... It's sort of organically developed, hasn't it, from TV and from this idea of, you know, the tube corrupting you.
It has indeed. And I mean, there's something very played. Well, first of all, there's something very... One of the things that's interesting about Wet Wired, which is kind of... It happens almost under the radar, is that there's a point where, like, he's talking with, like, the lone gunman, and they're talking about, like, how this technology wasn't perfected by the government. It was perfected by Madison Avenue, and Mulder's, like, the girl in the ice cube, to give an example there. And it's kind of interesting because the X-Files is always more wary of government than it was of private corporations. And arguably, like, that's the one thing that it kind of got wrong. It was, you know, looking at the world as it stands today, well, we definitely should be afraid of governments. It's arguably that we should be more concerned about, like, the people who control these industries, tech entrepreneurs, and people who also just, like, control the medium or the media through which we receive and process information. But there's also one of the things that I find kind of interesting in this is the idea that, like, Mulder talks about, like, the way that the television or the device works. And he's talking about, like, Helen Riddick was scared her husband was going to be unfaithful to her. It's like this guy whose family survived this trauma of the Holocaust was afraid that it was going to happen again. And it's this idea that what the television is doing is it's not necessarily, like, controlling people or shaping people in a specific sort of way. It's just making them afraid. And if you make people afraid enough by sending these signals, they will do horrible, horrible things to one another. And like, this is not a novel idea. Look at, for example, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street from The Twilight Zone back in the 50s. But it is something that's aged remarkably well, I think, when we look at the world around us.
It's strange. It's strange in that sense. It's a shame. It's quite desperately sad in a way that we've evolved to this point now, and we've sort of about 20 odd years on. The idea has grown. You know, the idea is
somehow developed. More relevant.
Right. Exactly, which I don't think we would have, if you know, you're watching Wetwire 10 years ago, you know, 15 years ago, I don't think we'd have thought that. I think we'd have started to think, oh, well, you know, with the emergence of these new media forms, this is going to be outdated, you know, this idea of the TV signal and that kind of thing, but it's not, you know. And but it's the tapping into the primal fears as well, which is interesting. You know, you talked about Helen Riddick, which is the woman who kills the man next door. You know, she's got this primal fear, obviously, of being cheated on, you know, of that aspect. You've got the Joseph Patnick, when he's watching all this news, he's transposed this figure of this mass murderer, and he's like he's a superhero in his mind. He's doing a good thing. He's killing, your killing days are over, you know. In his head, he's doing the world a great justice, you know, by killing this mass murderer. And obviously, what's really interesting, I think, what is the hook with this episode in many ways, and why it's sort of it's lingered with people, is that Scully's greatest fear is that Mulder will turn out to be one of them, and that she will have invested all of this in the X-Files. She will have invested all this in him over these last 3 years, and he will turn out to be the ultimate betrayer, and that he will be the one who got her sister killed, you know, and did all these terrible things, and that's her greatest fear, even though, you know, logically, she knows that's not the case. There is obviously this deep down subconscious terror that what if he was? You know, what if all of this I've done and this level of involvement I've given, and he turned out to be sitting in the car with the smoking man? Even though obviously when you look back at that, it's obviously X in that car, you know, or the plainclothes man. You know, when she's in that car park, it's obviously one of those two.
Or there's nobody there at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it's a great way of actually tapping into that really unspoken fear that Scully has.
I'll go one better, and I'll suggest that maybe, like, it's a way of literalizing something that she's not only afraid of, but on some level maybe suspects is true. And not in a sense of like, oh my god, Mulder's conspiring with the cigarette smoking man, but in a way of like literalizing the idea. And it's something that the show plays with a lot more when you get into the fourth season. I think it's maybe seeding some of its ideas kind of going forward, is the idea that like Scully realizes that every single horrible thing that has happened to her is a direct result of her association with Mulder. And what it does is it just visualizes that in a way that's very literal and very, like, very sort of direct. Because obviously if Scully hadn't gone to the X-Files, she wouldn't have been abducted, her sister would still be alive, she wouldn't be embroiled in all this. Like, there's a point where she's pointing a gun at Mulder saying, you did this, you put this chip in my neck. And while it's not literally true, and it never would be literally true because Mulder obviously wouldn't be party to that, there's a sense in which maybe Mulder does have some sense of responsibility for that. And it's something that the show kind of acknowledges and develops a little bit when it gets into the fourth season. But I wonder if they're not sort of seeding the idea here. And it's kind of interesting because, like, Wetwired is a show about how television and media are making us paranoid and making us turn on one another, right? But it's within the context of a show, The X-Files, which is about how ever scared you are of them, you are not scared nearly enough. There's a repeated point throughout the episode where, like, characters refuse to talk to one another on phones because they might be tapped. And, like, when Mulder says that to Scully, when he's like, I don't want to talk, this is an open line, and she hears the click sound, she's like, what's that? That's meant to seem absurd. That's meant to seem ridiculous. That's meant to be a sign that Scully has, like, gone off the deep end. And then later on, you have, like, you have sort of Frohickey, who's on the phone to Mulder, saying, come over to our warehouse, we'll show you there. We're not going to talk about it in the open line. You don't know who's listening. And you have this sort of almost reflexive quality. It's like that bit where Mr. X is like, I couldn't be here because everybody was watching me. But not on American television. Mm. Not for another 3 years. But over in Germany, lots of people were watching me. It's like that. But with sort of the show almost turning on itself, because there's this breakdown of social fabric and this sort of breakdown of trust, this paranoia that's seeping in that makes it impossible to trust one another. And one of the things that's interesting, the show, again, this is something the show develops much more in its fourth season in a way that I think is interesting. And it's a way that I think has aged the show very interestingly. I think Ingu Kang wrote a really fantastic piece for Vulture around the 2006 sort of revival, 2016 revival, where she sort of talked about how the show's sort of like, at once explore, the way that the show explores the breakdown of trust and paranoia can feel uncomfortable, because while it's lamenting the breakdown of trust and sort of the influx of paranoia, it's also in some way sort of fueling that in a way that it's creating this tension that it's also wary of. And I feel like in some ways, I don't think Wet Wire articulates it perfectly clearly. I don't think it's a laser pointed sort of criticism or a laser pointed bit of self-awareness. I don't think it's like Darren Morgan being like, well, look at me go. I completely understand what the show's doing and I'm going to make you think about it in a radical new way. But I do think that there's a level of self-awareness in Wet Wired where it's like, this is a show about people who are meant to be paranoid and who are meant to not trust anybody. It's a show with the anthem, Trust No One. And then it's like, well, what happens if people watch television and it makes them trust no one? Oh my God, wouldn't that be horrific? And part of me is wondering if the show is getting a little bit sort of like playful, reflective, sort of self-aware.
It could be. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. It could well be, really. And I suppose at this stage in you know the show's life, it's starting to get that that aspect of, you know, which it will build on in like certainly the sixth and seventh seasons of having that awareness and playing with the format, you know, significantly. And even though we're not quite at that stage yet, maybe there are hints that they're starting to think that way. So it's interesting. There's the little constituent elements I find interesting in this, like the fact that Mulder's not affected by it because of his colour blindness, you know, which is a really simple, it's a very simple, you know, an almost groan-worthy way of getting him out of the situation, isn't it? You know, oh, he's colorblind. Oh, okay then. Okay, he's not affected.
It's a very sort of it's a very episodic solution to the problem. It's sort of like his fear of fire in Fire. It's like, we will never talk about this again, but it serves to give us a dramatic hook in this individual episode that we're making. Like, if this were made in, like, 2016 or 2018, you'd have, like, it set up several episodes in advance. Mulder would mention he was, you know, red-green colorblind at DPO in order to pay off down here. But it's kind of, it's just like, oh yeah, I never mentioned that before. It never came up. Yeah. It'll never come up again.
But... And it will never come up again. Exactly. Yeah, but it works, I suppose, in that simple fashion. But I think one of my favourite moments in this, one that I think is really well done, is when Mulder goes to potentially identify Scully's body. Because even though obviously you know that Scully's not going to be dead, you know, they're not going to kill Gillian Anderson off halfway through the penultimate episode of the season. It's not going to happen. But the way it's filmed and the way it really allows David Duchovny to tap into that quiet terror that Scully might be dead, I think they do that really well. I think Rob Bowman really brings that out well, actually. And you know, all through this episode, Mark Snow's music I think is excellent. He really does a good job of marrying the paranoid delusional aspect to his, you know, his music. And I think that's that moment where it just, the music sort of comes down to, in fact the music in this is very Millennium, actually. You can see that he's starting to play around with. It's got a lot of the same, you know, the stuff you
pulsing
see in Millennium.
Pulsing piano, sort of, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's got a lot of that in it. So, you know, which you'll then bring onto Millennium in a matter of months, you know, from this. But you get that moment, that pulsing thing, when Mulder's just waiting for the blinds to go across and you see his face. It's just really well done, that is. And even though, like I say, you know it's not going to be her, You almost believe that maybe for a moment you always think, oh my God, is this gonna be? It's very good. It's very well put together.
I'm not a huge fan. Like, I think it's fantastic. I think the entire episode is fantastic direction. It's a great Rob Bowman sort of episode. And it's like, the thing about Bowman's direction is that even shots that in theory shouldn't be great, that are like purely functional, like look fantastic. Like, there's a moment where Mulder sneaks around the back of the suburban house where like the conspirators are meeting, and the camera pans slowly across this rotten pool as he's skulking, and it just looks wonderful. There's a moment earlier on where he's chasing after the cable guy, and the camera's pushing in on Mulder as he's running towards the van that's taking off, and it just looks wonderful and cinematic in a way that like a lot of 90s television didn't, and a way the X-Files really did, in a way that elevated the show as a whole. I think Bowman does a great job, but there are aspects of the script that I'm not usually fond of, and Scully's death or fake death is one of those, because I can't get past that there's no way it's Gillian Anderson. And for the amount of time and emotion that it invests in that, like, it serves a very clear plotting purpose, in that the whole point of that scene is to get Mulder to try and call Scully's mother so that he can realise that Scully's actually there because Scully's mother isn't answering the phone, despite the fact her daughter might be dead. So that's like the plot function that it serves. But it also, but it's a very, really hokey way of doing that. There's another moment later on where, like, after he discovers that the doctor is, like, given his number at the motel, he goes with the motel clerk and they have this big thing where they're going to break, they're going to open the room, and Mulder's even like, you know, do you want me to go first this time? And the motel clerk's like, damn right. And it's really tense and Mulder has his gun out and they go into the room and it's like, oh my god, everything's, the sheets have been sort of shimmied and it looks like the guy has just, like, sprinted and broke and made a run for it. And the motel clerk's like, yeah, I haven't had a chance to clear the room yet. He just checked out. What with all the excitement, I don't blame him. And you're like, it feels like you probably should have mentioned that to Mulder before you tried to storm the room with a gun. But the episode's, no, give us the scene where Mulder storms the room with a gun, because that's really exciting. And there's a lot of that in the episode that I don't think necessarily works as well as it might for me.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. I think, like I say, throwing all these different things into the kitchen sink, all these different characters, all these different, you know, stylistic ideas, you know, the way it films certain scenes, you know, is it investigation, is it action, is it all these things? It is a real hodgepodge all thrown into the mix. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I do like that scene with the autopsy, with the, you know, the identification.
But
I can see your point, because ultimately there isn't going to be a payoff to that. And you do know that in the back of your mind. But it's I think overall, you know, I think it's, and, you know, we've talked about the ending with, you know, Mulder's confrontation with X and that final scene with X and the Smoking Man, which sets up the next two episodes. Incidentally, Stephen Williams' favourite scene that I think
nice.
That's not something he told us directly. That's on record for long way back. But he does mention that in the interview about how he loves that scene. He really enjoyed acting with William B. Davis. But, you know, it sets things up, I think well in that sense. I think it's got some really good ideas. It's quite exciting in places, but it is one of that. I think in a way, I think Rob Bowman sort of sums it up. He's described it as, you know, I dug the script. I felt it was a good old fashioned show, and people who didn't like Ose Chung's From Outer Space would like Wet Wired because all the bad boys are back. A good, clean steak and potatoes type of episode, and do you know what? I think he's right there. I think that's kind of a good way to describe it. Really, it's not subtle. It's pretty in your face. It's all just out there. And I think you can either love it or, you know, I don't think it's a love or hate. I think it's one of them. You can go, yeah, that was fine. That was good. That was perfectly good. You know. But it's not going to be one of those, you know, the more you watch it, the more you unpick it, there are holes, there are things where it doesn't hold together like when we talked about Pusher. You know, it doesn't have that resonance, but it's enjoyable, and it's quite pulpy, I suppose, you know, and fun in that sense.
Oh, it is. It is very much like meat and potatoes is the perfect sort of summation for this sort of episode. Like, this is in some ways like a perfect X-Files episode while being an imperfect X-Files episode, because it contains all of the various elements that you would expect from an X-Files episode. It's got like this wonderful propulsive direction. It's got a great score. It's got cinematic value. It's got this sort of paranoia running through it. It's got murder. It's got an investigation. It's got a conspiracy. It's got all the elements that you would associate with a classic X-Files episode, and they are thrown in there like a kitchen sink. And I think it's the credit of like everybody working on it that like the penultimate show of the season, with all of these balls in the air, most of them managed to land properly. And like my biggest concern with it is that certain scenes are over melodramatic, and that like, the episode occasionally tries to kill a fly with a bazooka, as it does when the note is, we need Mulder to realize that Scully is at her mother's, and it's like, let's have him believe Scully's dead for 10 minutes, and it's like sometimes it feels like it's a bit much, but I like it a lot, and I sort of, it does have a charm. And I think it's a very hard episode to hate unless you're somebody who kind of lets those little things get at you. Like, I can understand if you're somebody who's like, you know, we talked about Pusher, and I remember we talked about Pusher, I was like, if you had to pick one thing that was wrong with Pusher, if you absolutely had to, it'd be like, maybe the mechanics of Modell's powers aren't explained in the most perfect detail. You get them, you understand them, the episode makes it easy enough to follow, but they're never clearly articulated in like an ABC sort of way. If you're the kind of person that bothers, I can see like this Wet Wired being an, oh dear God, why would anybody like like this. But otherwise, like, it's a perfect mishmash of, like, all the stuff that you like about the X-Files thrown into a blender and maybe stuffed to 110% capacity. And I kind of, I like it. I don't love it, but I enjoy it. And I've never sort of groaned at it. I've never hated it. And I mean, like, the fact that I don't like it as much as, you know, as much as other episodes in the third season is more to do with the fact that the third season is one of the best seasons of television ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's hard when you put it up against a lot of these episodes, you know, it is hard to really rank it as at the top. But, you know, it's...
I mean, it's worse than Blessing Way, we've established objectively.
Yeah, objectively, it's worse than Blessing Way. But, you know, before we jump on the mailbag, there's one last fact about this that's important to mention that is the crucial fact about Wet Wired, that this is the first episode where we hear the name John Gilnitz. And I think that's a very important point to make. And obviously, John Gilnitz being a classic, it's like an Alan Smithy, you know, of the X-Files. One of those kind of names that, you know, you throw in there randomly. And it was a hybrid of John Shiban, Vince Gilligan, and Frank Spotnitz. And it's a running in joke in the show of, you know, if there's somebody who you need to name quickly or there's a body on there, it's John Gilnitz. So, like, John Gilnitz becomes a little bit legendary. But this was the first episode where we hear about John Gilnitz. So all I can say is, a bit like James Bond, John Gilnitz will return. So let's turn this over to you guys for the Wet Wired mailbag, or as I said to Darren off air, the wet bag, which doesn't sound particularly pleasant, does it? But, you know.
it sounds better than, like, the Wet Wired mailbag, which sounds like some sort of maneuver that you attempt with somebody you truly trust.
Yeah. Either way, I think it's steering away from the episode in question, but... we've got some good comments on this. Quite a few of you were, you know, in the X-Files, X-Cast basement on Facebook. Quite a few of you got involved and have voiced your thoughts. I'm just going to pick through some of them before we say goodbye. So Dan Gear said, one of the very best episodes. It serves as both a standalone story as well as a link to the overarching conspiracy mythology. So you really get the best of both worlds here, which is kind of what we've already been saying, really. It sort of blends the two. Keely Portnow says, I'm a big fan of this episode. I love the story of paranoia and the suspense builds up really well. It's interesting to see it from Scully's point of view, as typically it is Mulder who is paranoid or has the weird experiences, which kind of goes back to the Anasazi thing you said, Darren, before, about Mulder being the one in that who was undergoing the paranoid delusion, and now it's Scully's turn. So she's sort of tapped into that a little bit, I think, there.
It is. I mean, it's also, like, one of the things that the third season does really well, and again, third season is probably my favorite season in The X-Files, is, and it's something that's kind of, it's something that Carter sort of almost hints at in the middle of the season when he does, like, is it Swisiji and then War of the Coprophages, but they're, like, they're the exact middle of the season, and they're mirrors of one another, because they're both sort of stories about towns that go completely on their minds. But the thing with Swisiji is that Swisiji is all about, like, duologies and, like, Jungian counterparts, and the idea that, like, you have two people who effectively complete one another and who mirror one another and how they act as forces on one another. And that sort of happens a little bit in the third season as a whole, where you have this sort of mirroring structure. So, like, if you take the third season and fold it in half, you end up with, like, the two mythology two-parters, which are obviously, like, Nicaea 731 and then obviously Apocrypha and Piper Maru. They match up perfectly if you fold the season in the middle. And if you look at the beginning and the end, you have, like, two mythology episodes that bookend the season. So you have The Blessing Way, and you have Paperclip, and you have obviously Wet Wired and Talitha Kumi. And, like, you can see that they sort of mirror each other in a way that's interesting. And one of the things the show does continuously, which I love about it, is that it mirrors the characters as well. So everybody has their own... Everybody goes through their own arcs, and all the characters remain unique and have their own vantage points. But they go through experiences that parallel and mirror one another over the course of the show, which is kind of... Which sort of, like, gives it this sort of mythic quality. So it's like Scully gets abducted in the second season, Mulder gets abducted in the eighth season. Scully has her near-death experience in the second season, then Mulder has his near-death experience at the start of the third season. And here you have, like, Scully going through that, like, breakdown, paranoid sort of what is trust? Can I trust my partner? My partner's lying to me, in a way that mirrors Mulder's own experience at the end of the second season as well. So I think that's some very clever sort of structuring. Now, I don't know. I don't imagine Carter sat down with a board and was like, well, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, we're going to wait several years. And we're going to do it again. I imagine it's more just like they had a set of ideas that they cycled through and they were kind of themes that they were interested in. But I really love that about The X-Files, how you have these arcs and rhythms that tend to repeat and play out for different characters, so that every character has a similar journey, but that journey is informed by who they are and their own experience, their own personalities, which I really, really love about the show.
That's really good insight. Yeah, it's really true. Sarah Devincompt asks if we have a definition for wet-wired, and I don't know how to translate it into French, and that's bothering me. Matt Latham said that it's linked to the idea of wetware and the process of connecting biological organisms to manufacture computers. And Keely Portnoy again says she believes it was a term invented by William Gibson in his cyberpunk novels regarding digital information being uploaded directly into the brain. And there's a little bit more in that in the thread on the basement wet-wired chat that goes into that. But it's something we didn't actually touch on in the main discussion there, Darren, about actually the terminology wet-wired, because it kind of, wetware was something that was sort of creeping in that period, you know, and it was this fusion of, you know, computer and biology. And it's something, I suppose, that comes back even more acutely in Killswitch in season 5, which really just sort of take this in a way to that next level.
Oh yeah, and very much a preoccupation of the 90s, the whole, the idea of like computers advancing to such a level that like, what if we're hardware and what's the software that's running on us, if we think of like computers as being so advanced and being capable of like things that are very close to what we imagine thought to be or how we conceive thought to be. So if we are biological hardware, like what's the software that's running on us, which is kind of interesting as well. And I think the X-Files, yeah, the X-Files is sort of like, it's fascinating with that. I mean, Gibson, obviously, he wrote, for example, that episode in the fifth season, Killswitch, which is one of my favourites, and I think a massively underrated episode of The X-Files. And I think that there is something in there, and I think that, like, even if we get back to wet-wired and wetware, it kind of plays into one of those recurring themes of The X-Files, which is a fear that, like, it's a fear of, like, being sort of, like, having our identities overridden or ignored, or having everything that makes us unique sort of scrubbed off and removed. The idea that we are all drones or clones, or that we are indistinguishable from one another on a fundamental level, that our identities don't actually matter. And so if you can do what they do here, which is, you know, provide a signal that it forces somebody to behave in a particular way that is massively out of character and fundamentally affects who they are and what they do and the choices they make, then what does that say about our identities and our personalities and the decisions that we make? Are they ever really our own? And that's sort of something that the X-Files comes back to sort of time and time again. And I think that even in Wet-Wired, it's not explicit, it's not overt, but I think it sort of plays into that theme in a little way, perhaps.
I think it does, really. I think that's really interesting. Dax Golding says, one of my favourites, in fact I just watched it last night as he types this, I love the teaser with Patnick seeing everyone as the Bosnian war criminal. Snow's score is superb as Scully slowly slips into paranoia. I entirely agree with that. And Chris Humphreys says, I love this one. Clearly mythology, but not needing the same level of attention paid to keep up. The foreshadowing of X's fate is well played. And Mulder going to identify the body is superb. I totally agree there, Chris. And I think I'm going to leave the final word for this one to Sarah Blair, our old pal, who says, I really like this episode because it has Skinner in it.
That's a fair observation. I can't critique it. I feel like we didn't talk enough about how this episode has Skinner in it. And I feel like that would have bumped up a whole star on my rating at the start of the episode if I talked about how much Skinner was in it.
He's not in much of it, but he is in there. As are the lone gunmen, and we didn't really talk about them either. It's one of those stories where everyone just
shows
sort of
up.
Pops up. Yeah. But I'm being slightly facetious. It's not all that Sarah says. She says, but okay, but really, I love the Scully ladies in this episode. Gillian Anderson and Sheila Larkin both brought a beautiful performance to the climactic scene. I'd say it ties with Je Suis as the strongest penultimate episode of any season. Which is interesting to think about, actually, in terms of penultimate episodes, you know, because so far we've had fairly, you know, the last two seasons before this, we've had like Roland and Our Town, which haven't really set anyone's world alight. So I suppose Wet-Wired is, you know, among the most interesting. Although personally, I think I would probably go for something like Demons next season as being a little better, a little more interesting. But But that's interesting to think
right?
of it like
Folly
that.
Folly Ado is a penultimate episode, right?
Right,
as well.
Folly Ado, yeah, which is also really interesting, really good. So it's people don't always think in the penultimate episodes, I suppose. But
when we're talking about penultimate episodes, Chris Knowles, who's been on the podcast before and is a really great X-Files writer, I absolutely love one of his observations that he's made, and I think it's spot on. You know, like you have those bits of, it's the jealousy test, I think, is how Jonathan Nolan's described it. When you read something somebody else has written, and you're so jealous of the insight that you kind of wish you'd thought of it yourself. But he makes the observation about the penultimate episodes where they're typically driven by, and then it's not always the case, but typically on The X-Files, as the season comes to an end, the penultimate episode tends to be driven by hallucinogens or hallucinations. And you think of, obviously, this is a prime example. Demons next season is a prime example. Folly Ado is also driven by hallucinations. Field Trip in the sixth season is also driven by hallucinations. We'll ignore Jesuit and Happy Days and stuff like that. But even if you come back to the miniseries, and this is going to be massively controversial, but it becomes somewhat literalized, where, like, in Field Trip, Mulder and Scully get trapped inside a giant mushroom in the penultimate episode of the sixth season. In Babylon, Mulder just trips on some giant mushrooms in the penultimate episode of the season. And I remember reading that and being really jealous, because that's an incredible insight. And I like that Wet Wired is sort of where it begins, because that's the one where Scully starts seeing stuff that isn't there, which I don't think you had in either of the two previous sort of penultimate episodes.
No, you didn't, actually. I've got to point out, Darren, that you just, instead of saying Sunshine Days, you said Happy Days, which is the best mistake, because now we really did have we did have a Jump the Shark episode, but now we've actually got the shark jumper himself, the Fonz. Yeah, I want there to be a Happy Days X-Files crossover now. You know, strange things have happened.
apologies.
That's great. Well, thank you everyone to who commented on the in the basement about Wet Wired. Some really good thoughts. Keep discussing, keep chatting about it, especially once the episode drops. But yeah, some fantastic thoughts there. Right, so thanks guys for your thoughts on Wet Wired. Some brilliant, you know, comments there. So we really appreciate you chipping into the mailbag. But that's it from us this week. You and I, Darren, are going to be back for the big finish, the grand fromage. At I don't know where I've got that from, the grand fromage. Doesn't that mean big yogurt in
I think
in
it's
French?
Big cheese. I think it's
big cheese. Well, you know, the Teletokumi is a season finale.
It's so, the big cheese.
It's the big cheese at the end of the rat's maze that is season three.
I'm we'll imagining more like Hugh Jackman in like the sequel to The Greatest Showman.
The Greatest Cheeseman. Yeah. But we'll we'll be back for Teletokumi next week. But in case you can't get enough Darren before then, why don't you tell us, you know, where people can find what you're up to?
Okay, so I do a whole bunch of stuff online. In fact, you may have a surplus of Darren by the time you're finished here. But I write regularly on my own blog, which is The Movie Blog, but it's spelled with a zero instead of an O in movie. So it's themzoviblog.com. I also write for an Irish Cinema Monthly, which is Cinéireann, which is available free online if you want to Google that as well. I co-host a weekly Irish film podcast called Scan On, where a bunch of myself and similarly minded or similarly aged Irish film critics sit down and talk about the week in film, whether that's news, what we watched this week, new releases, and the top 10. And I also then have a book out, which I'm very, very excited about, which is The Films of Christopher Nolan, which should be available, I think, a couple of weeks after this podcast airs. But you can pre-order it, if you are so inclined, on Amazon or any other bookstore as well. They can order it in. I'm very, very chuffed with this. It's something I've been working on a while. I'm very glad to be able to share it. It's one of the first film-by-film treatises on the work of what I think is one of the most influential directors working today. So it goes film by film through his filmography, 10 films, 10 chapters. It looks at both a little bit of their production history, their cultural context, and the legacy and impact of all of them, as well as exploring sort of the themes and preoccupations that run through his work. So I'm very, very glad to be able to share that. And again, I would be very, very flattered, and I absolutely love it if everybody could support that. And I mean, I understand it's a big buy, it's a large ask to order it in. If you do want to support it and you don't want to buy it, it is available on ebook, but it's also, you can order it into your local library as well. They have a whole budget allocated for this sort of thing. So if you can get in contact with your local library and ask them to stock it for you as well, that would be a win-win. You get to read it, I get some commissions, and you don't have to pay for it. That's fantastic. It's everybody wins. But no, I really, really am very proud of it. I'm very glad to be able to share it.
It's exciting. I'm looking forward to reading it for sure. And I know everyone listening, who especially who's read your work before, will be all over that, Darren. That's great. Can I suggest, though, book three, whatever it turns out to be, can I suggest it's named A Surplus of Darren?
A Surplus of Darren sounds like it's like a, what's a surplificity of nuns. Like, the plural of nuns is surplificity, which I quite like. It's like, any more than one nun is more nuns than you need in a given situation. Obviously, they haven't seen The Conjuring Shared Universe. Or they have.
I suppose it's like a Murder of Crows, isn't it? It's, it's the same kind of thing, really. Which sounds like a Game of Thrones novel, doesn't it? A Surplus of Darren doesn't really sound very Game of Thrones.
It doesn't sound particularly threatening. It's like, what's he going to do? Argue critically about you?
Well, you know, if you ever do the autobiography, I think there you go.
A Surplus of Darren. I can see the cover on it there. I'm lying on a bed with my feet up behind me and my knuckles under my chin, sort of impishly. It's like A Surplus of Darren.
Oh dear, that's got right. Commissioning, you're like publishing houses. You know what to do. We need this book. We need this book now. Yeah, okay, anyway, enough of this tomfoolery. We'll be back. You know where I am. AJ Black Writer on Twitter, and all the XCast stuff is in the credits. So, yeah, you know where we are. I'm so lazy now, I just go for credits.
Roll it there.
By this point, yeah. If you're still listening by this point, well done, and it's all in the credits. But, yeah, we'll be back next week for the season finale, and remember, until then, as always, trust no one. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.